Good morning, Council. The next case is 824-0728, State of Minnesota versus Jonathan Jones. You might already know, but as you can plainly see, Judge Bradfold is just here remotely, and so can see and hear everything, but you'll just hear audio if Judge Bradfold has questions. So, Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Council for Appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal. I understand that, Council for Appellants, you're going to, one will do principal and then the second lawyer will do rebuttal. Is that right?
Yes, for Appellants.
Okay, yep, that, and we have no objection from the state. No, no. Yep, well, we'll go ahead and do that then. And so when each of you starts your argument, please state, including on rebuttal, your name and the party you represent for the record. So, Council for Appellant, go ahead. We're keeping only an audio version of this live-streamed argument for our records on a public website. And as you might know, it looks good. The podium goes up and down if you need it. Does it look okay to you? Otherwise, the toggle switch is sort of...
About the same height.
Okay. Good? Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Okay, so we are ready for you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Gabe Ramirez Hernandez, and I represent appellant in this direct appeal. His name is Jonathan Jones, and with this information, you already have more than the officers who illegally searched, seized, and arrested him, making this appeal necessary. Mr. Jones was convicted of possession of a firearm by an ineligible person following a stipulated evidence court trial held in Hennepin County, and he was sentenced to 60 months imprisonment. The district court denied his pretrial motion to suppress, which was found after the police conducted the illegal, warrantless seizure, arrest, and eventual search of Mr. Jones's bag, which was not in his vicinity, was not in his immediate control, and was not subject to any exception to the warrant requirement under the Fourth Amendment. Applying de novo review, this court should reverse the district court order denying Mr. Jones's pretrial motion to suppress because probable cause based on informant's tip requires inquiry both into the quality and the quantity of information that is provided by that informant, and that some of that information be corroborated. Here we have deficient information provided by the informant, very minimal, and in the 20-minute surveillance, these officers don't observe anything other than entirely innocuous behavior. We've got folks sitting around at a place that all of these officers agree is a place in public that folks do barbecue, sit around. It's a high traffic area, and there's nothing to suggest that Mr. Jones was engaging in illegal behavior at the time. I'd like to first address the issue about the scope of this appeal. It's our position that the pretrial motion entirely encompassed both the seizure of Mr. Jones as well as the arrest and seizure of the bag. That was entirely encompassed in the pretrial motion. There was a record on it at the district court, and it was preserved in the Rule 26 waiver.
Is there any difference? I mean, I know there's a legal standard difference between reasonable articulable suspicion and probable cause for the stop slash and the arrest. Is there a difference in the factual circumstances in this case? Do the same factual, in other words, well, you understand my question. Seems
yes.
Like they're identical to me.
No, I think we're under both analysis, we're relying on the same information from the informant, the same deficient investigation, and not enough. So really the lack of reasonable articulable suspicion is a lower standard, and they fail to meet that. And certainly if we go to probable cause for the arrest, there's just not enough there here. But if you don't agree that it was preserved, even on plain error, this court should reverse on that ground. And on the facts, I'm aware that the court has likely read the record, but I just want to make one point particularly clear here, and one point that the district court erred in. The district court attributed activity to Reiser, to my client. The record is very clear that only Reiser was seen with a bag at his feet. At no point did anybody see Jones with a bag either at his feet, nearby him. That is just absolutely absent, and that is a mistake in the district court's order that was part of its basis for its conclusion. And just wish that we keep that clear here and not confuse the two.
You mean during the surveillance? No one testified that they saw a bag?
Correct. At the evidentiary hearing, none of the officers testified that they saw any black bag near him.
Was there evidence, like on the body-worn camera, that shows the bag next to the lawn chairs where he was sitting?
But not during the surveillance. And so he, before, and I'm talking before the seizure, before the arrest, there was just no reason to approach him and assume that any of the black bags were associated with him, particularly the one black bag. So, and I know this might be a bit confusing, so I'll take a moment here. Reiser is in red, and he's got ultimately the black bag that has nothing else to it. My client is described as having a white shirt, and he has the bag that ultimately has a conspicuous white lettering, white Nike lettering. And so Reiser in red is seen by the officer, and the officer testifies at the evidentiary hearing that the bag, that they saw the bag at Reiser's feet, the black bag. Nobody testifies that they saw the bag anywhere near Jones's feet or anywhere around him. He never had it on him. He didn't move it, never manipulated it, never opened it. At no point is he seen brandishing a gun. And so the district court's statement that one of the officers saw him with a bag is just factually incorrect and unsupported by the record. And part of this analysis is Cook is instructive here. Cook tells us that we need to have more than just innocuous activity here.
Counsel, this is Judge Bradfield. If I could just follow up real quickly so I understand your argument.
Please.
You mentioned the district court's error in its findings of fact, and I'm looking at the, I guess it's page 3 of the district court's memorandum, where the district court says the defendant was sitting in a black and yellow lawn chair with a black Nike bag resting at his feet. Is that what you're saying is not supported by the testimony?
Correct.
That was received at the evidence? Okay, just so I track you. Thank you.
Yes, and then also in the evidentiary hearing, that is also repeated, where I believe the state believed that it was, I mean, again, this is not a written submission, but the state believed, in the transcript, the state believed that it was my client who had the bag at his feet, and that's not supported by the record. And then the court then adopted that in response in summarizing the evidence. So, back to the seizure and arrest issue, which I think, again, follows a very similar analysis, but there's minimal details here. We don't have much more than we've got two folks, again, a very generic description, two black men. It's not age, height, nothing else other than they're two black men.
I just really want to focus on, I'm just going to go back one second, back to page 3. So it's the district court found, after a brief surveillance period, officers surrounded the area and detained everyone present, period. Defendant was sitting in a black and yellow lawn chair with a black Nike bag resting at his feet, period. So there's an detention, district courts of everyone, and defendant was sitting in a black and yellow. What's factually inaccurate about?
At that point, they've already seized him.
Right. It says officers surrounded the area and detained everyone present, period. Defendant was sitting in a black and yellow lawn chair with a black Nike bag resting at his feet. Chronologically, I see detention, and then he was sitting in a chair with a bag at his feet. Tell me what's wrong about that. Are you reading that as meaning that prior to the detention, the district court is saying he was seen with that black Nike bag?
Yeah, I was looking mostly at the transcript, but also, so to that extent, no, but I think it was under the standing issue, and so I don't want to say anything unclear without taking another look at it, but I believe there was an analysis about the standing issue, which we're not disputing today. There's no dispute that that bag was eventually Jones's bag, had identifying information in there, but I believe it was partly in that analysis. And so to the extent that gets muddied up in any of this else, I just wanted to bring that and make it very clear in this analysis that before they seized Jones, no officer saw the bag near him, on him. He didn't move or manipulate it. And so the officers didn't corroborate that this bag actually belonged to Jones or that he had anything to do with it, particularly when you have a group of at least six people in that area. And again, an area that's highly trafficked, 20 minutes is just, you know, a lot of time to be observing folks. And one other thing that I want to make clear is that part of the informant's information that wasn't clear here, for example, Mosley. In Mosley, we have contemporaneous information that the informant is actively seeing what is happening, whereas here, the officers didn't bother asking how soon this was. Was this an hour ago that you saw two people at this area where we have a lot of traffic? Was this 5 minutes ago? Was this now? That is just nowhere in the record. And that, coupled with a very minimal information, just isn't enough. I can't just say that somebody on the corner over here of the, you know, of the court has, you know, a particular gun, not provide their names. There's no way that the officers know that they are ineligible. The tip simply says, there are two people, two black men, one in red flip-flops, one in a white shirt. They've got two black bags, no other description, nothing about the conspicuous white lettering on one of them, and they're at this place. Nothing about, I'm seeing it now, I saw it 5 minutes ago, and particularly for this corner, this is Penn and Lowry, that's a busy corner. You got a bus stop there, there's already six people there. That information is important. That's information that the officers didn't have, didn't consider, and didn't bother corroborating. So they just go, they surveil for not more than 20 minutes, and they see nothing but innocuous activity, just as in Cook. And in Cook, they had even more. I mean, the officers at least had a license plate number. That's a little bit more identifying than I've got a black male at this area. And particularly when it comes to the vicinity. So I want to move on to the third part. So even seizure arrest, moving on to the search of the bag, in Cook and in Mosley, you've got vehicles involved. And so whatever's contained in the vehicle, it's certainly a different situation than a large area with several people. It's not in his immediate control. I'm not understanding what the exception was that allowed them to search that bag, even if there was an arrest. That's not a search incident to arrest. It wasn't his in control, not in his vicinity. This is not a vehicle. This is not Cook, this is not Mosley where you've got the vehicle, and even in Cook where they had the vehicle, that would have been improper. And so, again, I just want to reiterate, this is all about the quantity and the quality of the evidence that that just wasn't considered. Very minimal information from the informant and innocuous behavior. We have grilling, music. The officers are clear that that's what happens here. That's not a reason to suspect that there's anything illegal. And Cook requires more than just these innocuous details be corroborated. If I have no further questions, I'll rest there.
Okay, thank you very much. And counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Matthew Huff. I'm an assistant head of McCounty attorney, and I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. This court should affirm the district court's suppression ruling for two reasons. First, to the extent that the issue of the warrantless seizure of appellant is before this court, law enforcement had reasonable suspicion for the seizure based on the confidential, reliable informant's tip, premised on firsthand information, and subsequent corroboration of those details by law enforcement. Second, appellant's arrest was supported by probable cause, and the search of appellant's backpack incident to that arrest was a lawful search of his personal property immediately associated with him.
And then just to ask you the same question, is there any difference in the facts available, the circumstances available to measure the stop, the detention versus the arrest? In other words, was there any new information that the state relies on to justify the arrest that's not also involved in the stop?
No, Your Honor, I would agree with appellant that the facts are both applicable to the reasonable suspicion and the probable cause analysis.
Same facts.
Same facts.
Okay, correct. And you need to, in order to sustain the, for the district court's ruling to be sustained, the arrest has to have probable cause. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I'm just wondering why it matters that much, as you can tell by my questions, perhaps, about the detention, if the arrest needs to be upheld anyway, and it sort of seems like the same facts.
It would be the same facts.
Okay.
Regarding the facts, this came up during appellant's argument, and I wanted to address the fact about the district court's order, the finding that said defendant was sitting in a black and yellow lawn chair with a black Nike bag resting at his feet. So I would agree that the transcripts from the evidentiary hearing did not contain that information. However, that wasn't the only facts before the district court in this case, and so there was the body-worn camera as well, the footage of the four officers that was admitted. And so I'd specifically point the court to Exhibit 2, which is Deputy Hendrickson's body-worn camera. And the timestamp for what I'm talking about is 1 minute 32 seconds to 1 minute 35 seconds. And so in that footage, it shows appellant sitting in a black and yellow lawn chair, and as officers begin to move in for the takedown, appellant stands up, and then after that, that was where the black Nike bag was found resting, or was leaning up against that lawn chair, and that's where the search happened. And so I would disagree with appellant's position on that point, and I do think that it's contained in the record that that bag was sitting at appellant's feet.
Is the only difference between this case, I mean, I understand some factual differences, but between Cook and this case, that here there's some testimony about the CRI having firsthand information or having observed it. Is that, I mean, without that, would there be any way to affirm?
Your Honor, I would agree that that is the key to this case. And so I think in Cook, the issue was that the basis of knowledge for the CRI was lacking, and here we don't have that. So here in the record, it supports the finding by the district court that the knowledge of the CRI was firsthand. That's not something that's being challenged by appellant on appeal here. And so because of that, I think that under Mosley, we're okay just by having the firsthand knowledge with the CRI's tip. Law enforcement corroborated those minor details and as a result, under Mosley, that provides probable cause for the arrest.
But Mosley involved an informant with contemporaneous observation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
and the record is silent that the CRI in this case had that. I mean, that there was firsthand.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But under Mosley, it doesn't require a contemporaneous observation. And in fact, the court did an analysis and cited. I cited the two cases in my brief that were discussed in Mosley, but the court basically said that contemporaneous observation is not necessary. And in this case, we also have a fact that law enforcement conducted surveillance within 7 to 8 minutes of getting the tip. And so I think that in light of that, the contemporaneous observation fact isn't as relevant.
Let's go back to the underlying issue, at least in part. The defendant in this case was under the control of law enforcement at the time that bag was searched, correct?
I don't disagree that, yeah, there was a seizure that had occurred at that point.
Right. So he's cuffed and he's in the squad car and they've got this bag, right?
I would disagree. He was not in the squad car at that point. I think, well, actually the search technically happened before the arrest, but case law makes clear that if there was probable cause to arrest, that's okay.
He was under their control when the search was made.
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay. So there was no danger of any immediate access by the defendant to the bag or anything like that?
That's correct.
Right. So there was nothing preventing the police from getting a warrant at that point?
There wasn't, Your Honor, although in this case, the bag was immediately associated with his person, and so the fact that he didn't have immediate access isn't the relevant analysis, and that's actually why the district court didn't conduct that.
I understand, but it wasn't on his person, and it wasn't within his immediate control. Correct on both counts, right?
Correct.
So we're relying on that it was associated with him.
That's right. And in this case, officers knew or had reason to know that it was immediately associated with him based on, first, the CRI's tip saying that the black bag was in his possession. Second, during surveillance, Sergeant Lipinski observed the black bags near the two described individuals. And then third, we have Deputy Hendrickson's body-worn camera at Exhibit 2 showing the bag directly next to appellant and at his feet at the time of the takedown maneuver. So I think those three facts point to that it was immediately associated with him.
And they distinguished this from Cook?
Yes.
Is there in the record information that supports that the CRI said that there were multiple bags?
I believe that there is, Your Honor, yes.
That each of the two people that were being described each had a bag?
That's correct. So it was two black bags, yep.
Go ahead, Judge.
Is there evidence in the record as to how the CRI knew that they were ineligible?
There's not evidence of that, Your Honor. Although it is, the officer testified that this was based on firsthand knowledge, and so I assume that they knew somehow. But there's nothing in the record about that specific detail, no.
Although the record went, the officer was asked, so the CRI said what to you? Answer, they observed two individuals in possession of firearms. So I guess that is testimony from the officer that the CRI observed two individuals in possession of firearms.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Why does it make a difference analytically as to when the arrest occurs? And if so, why?
In our brief,
there seems to be some disagreement about when the arrest occurred, and how does that factor in?
I think in our brief, we argue that it doesn't necessarily matter just because at the time of the arrest there was probable cause, and so even though the search may have happened before the arrest, that under case law, that's okay. And so that's how I would respond. I hope that I answered your question, Your Honor.
Okay, and there's no factual, but again, there's no additional fact to consider between the detention and the time of the arrest. So if the arrest was valid at the time of what you say is arrest, it must have been valid under your theory at the time of the detention as well, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Yep, that's our position.
Okay, because at that point, whenever the bag was searched, I don't see in the record, but correct me if I'm wrong, at the time that the bag was searched, Jones's ineligibility was not yet ascertained by the police. Is that right? Except from
beyond
for
the tip.
The CRI's tip.
Correct. Okay. Although under Timberlake, that's not required. So Timberlake doesn't require that they have knowledge of the person's eligibility. And I guess that's the eligibility piece is if they have a permit, that's something that is a defense to the crime. But for probable cause and reasonable suspicion purposes, officers don't need to know that fact.
Is Timberlake a probable cause case or a reasonable articulable suspicion case?
I believe it's a reasonable articulable suspicion case, correct. Unless the panel has any further questions, I would ask that this court affirm.
Judge Bradfold?
Nothing for me, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And rebuttal for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. I'm Tony Atwal, and I also represent appellant Jonathan Jones in this direct appeal. Addressing the factual record as it pertains to the three legal issues raised in this appeal, which are whether this warrantless seizure, arrest, and thirdly, the search of the white-lettered Nike bag was lawful or not. The same universe of facts control each of those legal determinations. And looking at those facts, what's missing here is the quantity and quality of the information that was provided by the informant. It is sparse. The information here is simply that two black males, without any physical description of them, are wearing red slippers and a white tank top. That could be any number of individuals. The rest of the information is simply that they are at a certain location. We don't know when they were at that location. We do know the confidential, reliable informant has firsthand knowledge, but we don't know when it comes from. Is it from 3 days earlier? Is it from a day earlier? Is it from 5 hours earlier? The record is utterly silent. The confidential, reliable informant's information also lacks into the specifics of the alleged purported criminal activity. There's no evidence in the record that the CRI provided information as along the lines of the type of firearm he or she observed. Critically, Mr. Jones's bag is conspicuously marked with white Nike lettering. It's black. Within it are his personal effects, medicine and correspondence, and yes, the firearm that was found. The confidential, reliable informant never describes that bag. Instead, the informant describes a black bag, which during the police surveillance for 20 minutes, police observed with Mr. Reiser at his feet. So that is what is lacking. But that's not all that's lacking. Because there's a sparse amount of information provided by the confidential, reliable informant, the police can only corroborate that sparseness, which is they see two black males amongst many others in a highly trafficked area with lots of people, lots of lawn chairs, and they only see Mr. Reiser with a bag. Yet they initiate the takedown maneuver. And as the officers testified, this wasn't any particular suspicion what they were acting on. What they were acting on and doing was the description of the takedown is very telling about what was occurring here. The officer testified, quote, the intent was to stop the individuals, to identify them, determine if they were prohibited persons or permitted to possess firearms, or what the current situation was with that. That is unparticularized suspicion. That is a hunch. Even considering the totality of the circumstances, including the CRI's info, which again is sparse, that is insufficient to one, support a seizure, and two, to support probable cause for arrest. To touch on the record question about body-worn camera. So as we looked at the record we were provided and focusing in on the district court filings and focusing in on the transcripts, there is a discussion in the suppression hearing transcript found on pages 56 and 57 where the parties are discussing and agreeing to submit body-worn camera evidence to the court. The district court inquires about the form of that evidence and how it will be submitted to the court. We delved through the record, and we couldn't find another instance where that's actually submitted as a court exhibit for the evidentiary record. So we didn't see that. So what we are relying on here, as co-counsel pointed out, is on the transcripts and as we've read the transcripts. This court's decision in Cook is very instructive here.
Just to be clear, are you saying that the footage is not part of the record on appeal?
When we briefed this case, Your Honor, in all candor, we did not receive the body-worn camera, and our presumption was that it actually wasn't submitted because it's not in any of the materials that we were provided. There's a discussion about it, but we don't see it actually submitted as would be a normal course of entering evidence. But even if it is part of the record,
and you agreed for it to come in at the
yes, the trial counsel in this matter did agree, and there was a stipulation on that discussion on page 56 and 57 that they would want to submit it. We just don't see where it was actually submitted. But even setting that aside, let's presume it's all part of the record and that evidence can be used here. At the moment that the body, as
I'm just going to also note your time, so.
Sorry.
No,
may
go ahead.
Finish the sentence, Your
Please
Honor?
Please do, and then
Thank
wrap
you.
Up. Thanks.
At the time when the police body-worn camera allegedly shows Mr. Jones in his chair with the bag next to him, at that point he's already detained. So the seizure and the detention has already happened, and then he's going to be arrested. So I'm not sure if it's a dispositive in that part. Thank you, Your Honor, for letting me go over.
No, no problem.
And we
Thank
would
you.
Ask that the court reverse.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your briefing and your oral arguments this morning. A case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.